Hey, this is The Reason Interview with Nick Gillespie, and my guest today is Evan Barker, author of the new memoir, Nothing Left, Confessions of a Democratic Operative. She spent nearly 15 years inside Democratic politics as an Obama volunteer, a Bernie Sanders organizer, and especially a fundraiser who says you helped raise more than $50 million for Democrats. So you got a lot to answer for. In the book, you talk about how you entered politics because the Affordable Care Act made it possible for you to get health insurance with a rare lung disease.
Yes.
But you have left the Democratic Party. You announced this, at the Free Press right after Trump was elected. Mm-hmm. And what we're going to talk about now is things that you talk about in the book and how the Democratic establishment or the Democratic Party, you think, has lost touch with working class voters. Let's talk about that. And then also, you know, where things stand in terms of, you know, that vote for Trump. Do you still like that or not?
Yeah. But,
Evan Barker, thanks for talking to Reason.
Thank you. And just one little correction. I didn't work directly for Bernie. I worked with his team and I worked with the far left progressive wing of the Democratic Party.
Right.
Yeah. So just a little correction.
No. Let's talk about this. You liked the Bernie Sanders circa 2016.
I did.
Okay. What was that run? What did you like about Bernie Sanders then?
So I got reactivated by Democratic politics. I kind of took some time off. In college, I had to work in college. Mm-hmm. And I was also going to school full time and I was sick. Yep. So I was waitressing and I didn't really have as much time to dedicate to campaigns.
Right.
But after Trump won, I was like, oh, my God, what have I been doing? I need to get back out there. And so I moved to the East Coast, to New York. I lived in Bushwick with socialist, very spoiled roommates that had trust funds and loved Bernie. And I didn't really get Bernie at that time. I had kind of grown up as a solid normie Democrat.
But it's interesting, you grew up as a normie Democrat in Kansas, which is one of the most, or used to be one of the most Republican states in the country.
Well, Kansas and Missouri.
Yeah.
I claim both sides.
I see. Okay.
Because we were kind of both going back and forth.
Okay.
Most of my family lived in Missouri, actually. Yeah. But a lot of them were union Democrats. Mm-hmm. That's part of it, is that they worked in labor unions and construction workers, blue collar guys. Mm-hmm. And so I grew up going to union halls, you know, and it was a source of stability for my family. So that was part of the reason. And my mom, the first book she ever read to me, My President, Bill Clinton.
Wow.
So I was kind of like giving those messages. He's like, oh, shit.
Although Clinton is, you know, he's like a union buster, right?
In
Democratic Party lore, Arkansas is. Like,
oh, yeah.
And NAFTA.
He was the beginning of screwing over the working class, sure. And part of the disillusionment. My mom doesn't like him now.
Okay.
But, you know, she likes Trump now, actually.
Yeah.
But so I got reinvigorated by Democratic politics. I went to the East Coast. I started working for this establishment, just milquetoast woman in New Jersey. And I actually don't name her in the book. She's the only person
Who is she, though?
Why? Well, I don't want to name her.
I tried figuring it out.
But her name is Karen in the book. And her husband was with Lehman Brothers, and they owned three homes in New Jersey.
So he had, by 2016, had a lot of free time.
He
had nothing to do.
He was a magician.
Yeah.
Literally. Yeah. He would dress within a top hat and a cape.
Yeah, it's very funny the way you described.
Read it? Okay, read it. Yeah. And so I would just get really frustrated with them because I just felt like they didn't really give a shit.
Yeah, when you say that, define kind of like, because, you know, the people you're drawn to in the in Democratic politics
outsiders.
Are like Bernie, outsiders, but also kind of on the left, the progressive left. Mm-hmm. You have a problem with identity politics.
Oh, hell yeah.
We'll get to.
Hell yeah.
So what's the problem with the Democratic establishment? I guess the Karen
empty,
character.
Yeah. Empty, nothing, just wants power. Mm-hmm. Obsessed with all the wrong things. Obsessed with abortion. Obsessed with saving democracy. Issues that don't connect with like anybody in my family when they go to the ballot box. And so I got frustrated. She didn't really want to, she wouldn't talk about the real issues. And so, and on top of that, she wasn't like a nice person to deal with. And so I went, I was going through a lot. My stepbrother had just died in the military.
He's in the Navy. It wasn't a military accident, but his boat ran into it.
The ships collided. Yeah. And that really fucked me up. Mm-hmm. And I left, went back to Kansas, and just ended up happenstance finding, I needed a job. Okay. I worked at a pizza. I didn't put this in the book, but I worked at a pizza. I was always a hustler. Yeah. Like I was a hard worker. And I went right after the campaign, I went to a pizza place and just worked for a month because I needed to get cash, you know?
I was born in Brooklyn, raised in New Jersey.
Yeah.
I just want to point out that Kansas and Missouri pizza is terrible.
It's horrible.
But it's good that you got work.
Barbecue.
Yeah.
We got good barbecue. You can't say any. Oh, okay. These are fighting words.
So, but the establishment Democrats, just for you, they don't care about the working class.
No, they're just addicted to corporate donors.
Is Hillary Clinton kind of the apotheosis of that?
They're neocons, basically. Yes. I mean, her and then I think later Kamala Harris. She was, I say this later in the book, but she was sort of the manifestation to me of the establishment wing of the Democratic Party. I mean, she had sort of been co-opted by some of the more progressive social issues, but that was her campaign to me just completely rang hollow.
What about Joe Biden? Because he was Joe from wherever the
Scranton. Fucking,
yeah, from Scranton.
Joe from
thank
Scranton.
You. Who had like, a million billion Amtrak miles and obviously had never, he'd been financially secure from the time he was like 10 years old.
Mm-hmm.
But did he appeal to you? And he ran in 2020, the Washington Post said he ran on the most liberal platform that any Democratic candidate had. And he spent a lot of money, talked about the working class all the time, but that he didn't connect.
No, at that point in time, I was deep in the progressive world.
Okay.
And I really bought into their theory of change.
So,
and I viewed him as a threat to that.
So Bernie, particularly in the 2016 run, I mean, he's coming out of, the Occupy movement is a few years before, but he is not even a Democrat. He's an independent. Mm-hmm. He's a progressive. He calls himself a Democratic socialist or whatever.
Right.
What is it about the Sanders broadly and
the
people
drew
like
me
him,
in.
The platform.
Yeah. So I was there the day that he and AOC actually ever met the first day they ever met, the very beginning of this movement.
Right.
And I just felt like he wasn't afraid to directly talk about his solutions for people. I was frustrated with Obamacare. Mm-hmm. I even though it did help me, I was frustrated with the fact that I'd move across state lines and I'd lose my insurance. And as a person who's really sick, like it's risky, you know what I mean? And it was still expensive and, there were problems, right? There's still problems with it, tons.
Right.
And so, he said Medicare for all. It's funny, now I don't really support Medicare for all either.
Maybe we can come back to that.
But at the time, at the time, I don't want a system like Canada. But at the time, I was like, oh, yes, this is what we need. He doesn't take corporate PAC money.
Right.
He disavows all this shit. He doesn't have to talk to donors all day. I got disillusioned, too, by just the brutality of fundraising.
Yeah.
And this exists in both parties. They're completely captured by donors.
In many ways, that's the most interesting part of your book
to me,
which is just like kind of, showing how often candidates and elected officials spend most of their time dialing for dollars.
That's
right?
It.
And you talk, it reminded me years ago, I talked to Republican Congressman Trey Radel, who got bounced before his first term even ended because he got arrested in a drug scandal. But he wrote a book in 2017, and a big part of it was like, he thought, I made it to Congress. I'm going to be able to enjoy this. And all of the time, he was just dialing for money. Talk about, I'm sorry, I don't have it right in front of me, the hard ask or like you talk about one of the things that you did as a fundraiser is when candidates or people would be talking to a donor, a prospective donor, you would be like, on the other side mouthing, like, ask for this.
Yes.
What's that called?
It's called the hard ask.
Okay. It is the hard ask.
It's my phrase. Yeah. I don't know if everybody... But I noticed, you know, like you said, a big part of it is just 8 hours a day. Mm-hmm. You know, if you're a successful politician, that's what you have to do.
Yeah.
And it's like this when you're running for office, then it doesn't stop. Right. And, you know, and then you start raising for your party and, you know, it's just like a never ending. And your election is, you know, you get into Congress and you only got 2 years. Right. So I noticed, you know, we'd be just be calling usually extremely wealthy people or upper to middle class people all the time. You know, the staff does a lot of work beforehand. I mean, we get as many details as we can. We look up every donor that they've ever get or every candidate they've ever given to. We look up their net worths if we can, their house, how much their house is, mm-hmm. their occupation, if they have an occupation, many of them don't. And then we create some sort of ask based on all of this information that we have. And even if someone was super rich, like even if you're calling a Google co-founder, for instance, right? You don't ever assume that they're going to give you the true amount that they can give you, which is the double max out, which is where, and actually people don't realize you can give. I would always ask candidates to ask for money for the general election too, even if they were running in a primary. Mm-hmm. You're not allowed to spend it, but it's helpful because it boosts your first initial fundraising report.
So
it's kind of smoke and mirrors for the public, right?
But that's good because it's also one of those things where it's like if you report big numbers, then people are more likely to give you money. They're not going to say like, oh, you have enough money. They want to back a winner.
They want to back a winner. They want to see you're viable. So the first quarter is the most important. Mm-hmm. And I was ruthless. Yeah. And on that first progressive campaign, I made him the front runner in Kansas because within 6 weeks, we raised $250,000. Mm-hmm. And it was by being ruthless and me just saying, make the hard ask. Like, and it's funny because you get into these rooms with these politicians. I've probably done call time at this point in my life with at least 50 politicians, I would say, maybe more. I don't know. And they all sort of, some of them are really shameless. Some of them, and those are the best fundraisers, the ones who just listen and they're like, okay, I'll do it. But a lot of them are sort of mealy-mouthed about it. They're afraid. They kind of like want to dance around it. They just don't want to ask for a commitment. So my job was to just constantly be beating them down.
Right.
And keeping them on task and keeping them focused.
And then you were saying like, you know, you're on the call and you would be filling out the form.
Yeah.
So that when the, you know, and they would might have to ask three or four times in the same call. But once the person said, okay, I'm in for X, you would have the form filled out and sent to them. So, you know, because you want to lock
most,
it down.
And a lot of donors and a lot of fundraisers don't do that. They're just like, oh, we'll send you an email. We'll send you some mail. That's it. Like, they'll do it. They'll do it. Everyone is a well-intentioned liar.
Yeah.
That's what I would tell candidates because.
And this, again, this is Republican, Democrat.
Doesn't matter.
Liberal, progressive, conservative, libertarian, whatever.
Right. Like, right. And I'd make them barter. Like, if they couldn't, you know, if we asked for $2,800 or, you know, $5,400, whatever it was. I think now it's like $6,300 or $6,200. And they said no. Then I'd like hold up a whiteboard and I'd be like, okay, half it, half it. It's better to get half today. Okay, no to that. Okay, we're going to ask for 1,000.
Yeah.
We're going to ask for 1,000. And then in between, I would instruct the candidate to give them a reason to do that. So like creating a sense of urgency. So we need it today because we're going to do an ad buy at the end of end of the week, or we need it today because our deadline is 14 days away. Sometimes we just create deadlines.
How does this work? I mean, did you work with PACs that are not affiliated with candidates so that they can raise as much money?
Independence?
Yeah.
Expenditures? Yes. I did that later in my career. Okay. I did a super PAC for John Fetterman.
Do you think that, and then I want to get back to the broad Bernie kind of program and what you found appealing about it beyond Medicare for All, but is there... You know, is there any kind of campaign finance reform that is worth pursuing? Because, you know, politics is always going to require a lot of money.
Yeah.
And you can say, okay, well, we're going to make it so only you can only, you know, contribute this amount of money. And then there's always ways around it.
Right.
And, you know, since at least Citizens United and effectively before that, because wealthy people always find a way to kind of spend their money in a way that they want, you know, should we stop pretending that we can actually regulate campaigns, you know, electioneering communications through the law?
It's a really good question. I thought about this. I think, so I used to believe when I was in progressive politics that the way forward was the public financing of elections.
Oh, yeah.
But I actually anymore, don't right? think that that's a good idea. I don't think it's a good sell to the American taxpayer.
No,
and you'll love that.
Why not tell me I have to support your religion
right.
or your yoga practice?
Like, why am I going to pay for you to run for office?
My whole point is, right. I don't want to pay for politics.
I think there's better things we can spend our money on. Yeah. And so I have heard some interesting Republican-esque proposals about this from candidates who are disillusioned, or not candidates, but people that are disillusioned about this issue. And they've proposed putting just a cap on the amount that politicians are allowed to spend in elections. Mm-hmm. So that effectively would, you know, if you say, like, okay, if you're running for U.S. Senate, you can only spend $10 million.
Right.
Or if you're running for U.S. Congress, you can only spend...
But then the minute you say something like that, then you have to have, a process by which you report
it's
everything.
So hard.
And then, like, I'm Joe Billionaire, and it's like, say, I interviewed John Fetterman, who I've known for a long time, who once threatened to beat me up on Bill Maher's Real Time. we've gotten past that. And he's a very interesting character, particularly lately. But, say I like Fetterman or I don't like Fetterman and I just start running ads, you know, that go along with
it's
his
the
stuff.
Citizens
yeah.
United thing.
Yeah, why
it's
not?
Like it's you like know, the only way to
free
do
speech.
It. It's it is. And I mean, is it? I don't know. I wrestle with this. I'm open to being wrong. I really am.
My dream is that somebody will run what appear to be positive ads for a candidate, but are actually putting them down.
That's
so
not going to happen.
Only John Fetterman could fall down a flight of stairs with such grace or something like that.
That's hilarious. Know? I kind of did something like that with, so I ran an ad against Dr. Oz.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Yeah. And
I talk about shooting fish in a barrel.
I know. It was really silly, though.
I charcuterie.
I had,
God, the price inflation on charcuterie is through the roof.
I had him. It was really fun. I like poked fun at him, but it was sweet. It was sort of like this kooky music. And I did a video of him making smoothies in his kitchen and he's like it was funny I don't know I think outside of a constitutional convention you'd have to change it just seems like it. And then the counter argument is that if billionaires aren't able to spend their money on elections, they're going to just buy media companies and they're going to influence like Elon with X like they're going
a lot at the Free Press, which is now owned by CBS News, which is on Paramount Plus, et cetera.
And so they could just consolidate their influence that way. That's the other way
but
to do it.
But it never works that way. I mean, one of the weird things about billionaires trying to influence politics is, going back at least to William Randolph Hearst, the big, San Francisco Examiner guy and everything. And it's like, it never works.
It never works. I don't know what the answer is, but I don't like it. I still don't like it. And it's disillusioning. And it's kind of a sick system.
So, let's go back. So Bernie, Medicare for All, you liked. And as much as anything, and I mean, it was interesting when Bernie Sanders and a few years before him, Ron Paul, they're kind of similar. They're old crotchety guys who are super principled or appear to be. And they were blunt about what they were saying as opposed to all the blow-dried.
Of the appeal.
What else did you like about Bernie?
The authenticity.
Yeah.
And I write that in the book. It's like when I met him, he was the exact same on stage, backstage, on TV. Yeah.
He's not a nice guy.
Right? Yeah.
Like he didn't care about you. You write that he didn't care about any individuals. He cares about his ideals.
Yeah.
So in that way, he's admirable.
Spot for him,
it's admirable.
Yeah.
But then you describe in particular in that, when you brought Bernie and AOC together, and she had just won her primary.
Yeah.
So she wasn't quite yet the AOC, that she was to become. But what happened, either with Bernie? Do you think Bernie, was it the Democratic establishment? Obviously, they wanted him to lose. But was it that, or was it just that the coalition that he was trying to build just wasn't big enough.
Do you mean when you say what happened to Bernie, do you mean like why did he go in a different direction?
Well, I guess two things. In 2016, yeah, and I mean, I guess there's that moment in, I think it was in Seattle in 2015, uh-huh. where, you know, he's giving a speech and a couple of Black Lives Matter advocates take the mic.
Yeah.
And after that, he came back and they were saying he wasn't attuned enough to criminal justice reform and to race issues. Because and Bernie used to say, like, I believe in class politics. And this makes total sense. If you're a socialist, a communist, anything on the Marxist side, you should be talking about class, not race, because you say capital, you know, capital sorts us into races to, so we fight each other.
But
rather
you can't
than
really ever unify
capitalists.
If you're just sorting by race.
Yeah.
And that's something that I saw.
Do you think that happened to him?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes,
I do. And AOC as well.
Well, I think AOC was always of that mind. Uh-huh. I think that she's part of the push, to be honest with you. I think Bernie, after he lost, he had a choice he could make. He could either do an RFK, right, and run again as an independent, or try to just completely oppose the Democratic establishment. Right. And he still opposed them, but he also played ball with them as well at times. And I think he saw AOC and he saw Rashida Tlaib and Ayanna Pressley and Ilhan Omar, that they were the first iteration of the DSA-aligned and, you know, candidates that we're now seeing take over Democratic politics. And I think he saw them as his future. Like, those were his future message bearers.
So
they were going
to
carry his movement.
You know, he's like the guy who runs Charlie's Angels, right? He wants to have this nice squad.
Those are his angels,
good-looking girls, young women around him who have energy and power.
Yeah, and he was...
And they're aligned with him. I mean, they're all like, oh, yeah, Medicare for all.
Yeah.
All, you know, whatever.
They're all running on his issues, but they're also bringing all these other issues into the fold. And I think he was getting all of this pressure from people in not really the Democratic establishment, but more in the progressive sphere, from people like Pramila Jayapal, who is in charge of the Congressional Progressive Caucus. And he's getting all of this pressure. And then also from the more identity-obsessed, focused aspects of the base of the progressive movement, too, the voters themselves. You know, he's probably fearful of not being able to really build the movement that he wants to build if he can't build this coalition with them. So I think that's part of the reason that in 2020, he ran such a different campaign. Mm-hmm. He hired different people and he focused more on race and racial politics and all of these other things that weren't really a part of his big movement in 2016.
Where does somebody like Elizabeth Warren fit into this? Because she's more conventionally Democratic. She's establishment. Mm-hmm. You know, she was at Harvard Law.
She's both.
She played the identity politics game at various, you know, points in her career. But is she part of the problem or is she the solution for you? Are you
No, she's not. She's not. I mean, to me, she's also the identity politics, adopts the cultural issues that I think are just completely a turnoff. And on top of that, she herself, I think she comes off sort of like a college professor. Like she also has on top of the
school mar.
Yeah. On top of the the adopting all of the far left squad DSA culture issues. She also has some of the problems that the establishment have, too. And that's that she's sort of paternalistic sounding, I think, to people. It's ironic. She's from Oklahoma, I think. But I think just kind of comes off as a coastal elitist type.
I mean, she's gone into that
from academia.
Sure.
I think like
she's lecturing.
She's lecturing. She drives some of the wedge, I think, between non-college educated voters and college educated voters. That seems to be the biggest polarization of our politics right now and the biggest problem that the Democrats have, really.
Yeah. How? Why is that a problem? I mean, and, you know, looking at when you go back through like 2016, 20, and 24, one thing that happened is that the Democratic Party started losing lower income households, particularly non-college educated households. Why couldn't they hold on to them while talking about identity politics?
Well, I think So some of it goes back even further than that. Some of it goes back to decisions, I think, that were made in the 70s to get rid of union influence at the DNC. And so, and then I think with Bill Clinton signing NAFTA into law and the World Trade Organization policy, I think those trade deals, I know for a fact, like they pissed off people in my family.
Right.
That ended up losing their businesses to places overseas. And because the tariffs were lowered. Sorry. But it's true. Like it, and so I know people that said they would never vote for Democrats again after that and started voting Republican at that point.
And I don't dispute your feel. You know, we don't have time to do, you know, slug it out over economic analysis.
But
I get.
But that's how they felt. That's
right.
True.
And that's really particularly true of people in the
Rust Belt.
Yeah, I was going to say the industrial or post-industrial Midwest. I was in grad school in Buffalo in the early 90s before NAFTA was signed. And Buffalo peaked in 1950, but people there were like, oh, NAFTA will kill us. And it's like, no, you've been dead for literally for 30 years.
But then
years.
It got worse.
it's unclear, to be quite honest. But
I
know what
you're
saying.
It definitely got worse where I'm from. It did.
And
you can even see it when you drive through Missouri. If you drive through towns that have like a manufacturing base, like, or, you know, they're manufacturing something, it's just the town just, it feels wealthier, like the people are having more of a middle class life. And then you drive through these other parts like St. Joseph, Missouri, you know, which isn't like so many jobs were lost there. And it
it's been
boarded up
since the Pony Express.
But it was a good, you could have a middle class life there.
I mean,
in the 1990s, like working at Lee's Jeans Factory, you really could. And it's just, it just keeps getting worse. But
But for sure, there was a shift where people in those areas, or your relatives you're talking a lot about. And one of the things I really respond to in your book is it's very much about class. And you talk about
it
even when you showed up working for progressive causes on the East Coast and people, you kind of really throw shade on Tory Burch wearing, the Democratic operatives. But, you know, it's interesting to see. And so this is also the space that Trump absorbed, right?
Well, he talked about bringing those jobs back.
Yeah.
And he also didn't talk to them in a condescending, patronizing, I'm looking down on you sort of way. And I think I think this is funny. Bernie's rhetoric and a lot of the squad's rhetoric, like they talk about really wealthy people with such disdain. But when I talk to my relatives and a lot, you know, my mom, she's not doing well. Like she's struggling still. I help her with rent. I do every month almost. And she, like when she talks about Elon or Jeff Bezos or any or Donald Trump, she's like, I love that they're successful.
Right.
I love that they're rich.
Yeah.
It's amazing. They're making jobs.
So every time an Amazon package shows up, she's not like, damn you, Jeff Bezos.
No,
and now I'm opening the package.
Right.
She's like, yeah, this has transformed my life.
She's like, hell yeah. They don't have the same resentment towards the, it's very interesting.
Well, there's a performative problem here, right? Where like Bernie, or and maybe not Bernie, but you get the sense with some progressive Democrats that, they hate Elon Musk and they hate Jeff Bezos.
They hate wealth, but
then they really
don't.
They really hate working class people who have shitty taste in clothes or don't know the difference between salad forks and, you know, and
don't know how to eat an artichoke like me. In the book.
Oh, God. You grew up in the wrong part of the Midwest.
I know. I did. I remember when I moved to the Bay Area.
Yeah.
And I went out with my husband. He's from a different social class than me. And he took me to a restaurant with his friends, and they ordered an artichoke, and I just put it in my mouth, and I started. And everyone's just like, performance art piece over here. You know?
Right. George, I think it was George H.W. Bush at some point when he was running for president back in the 80s before he was elected, but he ate a tamale completely through the corn wrapper. That became like a mini story. So it works both ways, right? You know, like the wealthy people don't understand street food.
Yeah.
But talk a bit about Trump, you know, so Trump came in and, you know, in 2016, especially, he used a FDR term. He said, I'm speaking for the forgotten man
yes.
and the forgotten woman. And he said, like, yeah, I'm going to bring Carrier air conditioning back, or I'm going to make it stay in Indiana. And was that what was appealing to you about Donald Trump at the same time you were kind of being turned off by the Democratic Party that
yeah.
you had raised millions of dollars for?
Yeah, I think. So I went to a Trump rally in after I posted this viral video on TikTok when I left it when after the DNC that I was really pissed off.
Yeah.
I went there and they were just talking about joy and abortion and
right.
saving democracy. And I couldn't deal with it anymore. So I went home and I posted my resignation letter online, yeah. woke up the next morning, got millions of views, never mm-hmm. expected that. And then people kept saying, you need to go to a Trump rally, you need to check it out, you know, and at that point in time, I was not planning to vote for him.
Yeah.
I was probably not going to vote. I wasn't going to vote for Jill Stein either. A lot of
right.
people thought I was like going to be, and
Dr.
I'm like, no,
Jill,
no, please. No, she
no.
wants reparations, like, mm-hmm. She's got all this. And so I went to a Trump rally and I was just sort of in awe by how he just talked about the place I was from mm-hmm. and bringing jobs home and no tax on tips, mm-hmm. making things in America again. You know, it was like all the things that I had hungered for Democrats to say for years that I wanted them to say. And it all kind of hit me. And I was like, fuck it, I'll vote for him.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I'll try it. And on top, so it was that. It was like the fact that he ran on the issues that I cared about, which were, you know, I cared about the forgotten people of this country. And he also, that was half of it. And the other half was that I was just pissed off at what my party had become.
Yeah.
And there was also just, I was a little impulsive too.
Yeah.
Got it.
Well, you know, now, so that, you know, that's November 2024. He's been in, second time around, he's been in office for a year and a half. It's coming
yeah.
up, or, you know, it'll be 2 years in a bit or since the election. He really hasn't delivered on any of his promises, right?
He has done some things I like.
Yeah.
He ended DEI.
Mm-hmm.
I was ecstatic about that. I thought that was one of the best things he mm-hmm. did. He closed the border.
Right.
I was happy about that.
Yeah. Although, you know, actually Joe Biden did in his last year in office. Well, I mean, probably because he was feeling
at the very end
yeah.
after tons of people had already
yeah.
come in. I mean, flooded the zone. He closed the border and he...
Fixed the reflecting pool, obviously, right?
Yeah, that was really, really praying.
Got a
that
great new airplane.
Building a ballroom.
From a kind of frenemy country.
Yeah, yeah.
Probably never be used again.
Yeah, yeah. yeah. I mean, no tax on yeah. tips. He yeah. did put that into the big, beautiful bill.
Right.
No tax on overtime. Although, I don't think that those policies are really as
right.
wide-reaching as and
yeah.
as effective as what we thought. I like the philosophy behind his tariffs.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't like the way that these were rolled out.
Hmm.
I think that it was too blanket. I would have liked it to be more targeted the way that it was hmm. in his first administration.
And this is something he kind of shares with Bernie Sanders, who
yeah.
is definitely a critic of free trade or
yeah.
free trade agreements,
yeah.
Sanders would say, and supports certain tariffs, et cetera. But so, I mean, what's interesting to me is, you know, and I guess in 2016, there was this big discussion of like voters who voted for Obama twice and then voted for Trump
yeah.
because they were turned off by Hillary Clinton or they were not being spoken to.
People like that, yeah, in my family.
But now, you know, now that Trump has come back and he's more Trump this time around, more populist,
yeah.
but he's not really delivering, does that make
yeah,
you?
I mean,
because you're an independent, you're not
yeah,
like
no,
a Republican.
I am. And there's also the Iran war.
Yeah.
That I...
Well, we've won it at least a dozen times.
I know. So we like what are we doing?
Keep racking up wins.
We've won. So why are we still... I don't
yeah.
know. It's just... So the Iran war has been disappointing.
Well, I guess I'm sorry, we're running...
The Medicaid cuts.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's really upset
well,
me.
You know, part of what your book is about how you think people like Sanders and AOC or other progressives, regardless of where they start out, you know, they kind of get absorbed into the establishment structure.
That's probably what's happened with him.
Yeah.
It's probably that there's like big business donors in the Republican Party and that he's trying to appeal to them. And he has, and I think...
And he did appeal. I mean, he got Silicon Valley, which was famously anti-GOP or certainly anti-Trump, came around in 2024.
Yeah.
Are they calling the shots? He, you know, he's gone after Anthropic and a couple of other AI companies.
I don't know.
It's very complicated.
I don't know. But, you know, I don't regret my vote for him.
Yeah.
This is what I don't regret my vote. I don't regret voting for Joe Biden. I don't regret working for progressives. No. You do what you do with the information that you have at the time. Right. Yeah. And everything's a life learning experience.
Right.
I probably wouldn't vote for him today.
Yeah.
If the election were today. Like, I would probably just sit it out. And I think that is what might happen in the midterms, actually. Mm-hmm. A lot of people that voted for him, the Democrats are thinking that they're going to just default and vote for them.
Right.
I don't think that that's necessarily going to happen. I think that there's just going to be a suppression of voter turnout on the right.
And it's not a suppression because of illegal
immigration. No. It's like people, yeah, people that I know that voted for him are like, I don't like it anymore, you know, just the truth.
How old are you?
35.
Okay.
I look younger.
Yeah, absolutely.
Thank you.
And you sound younger.
Great.
You know, you sound like you just fell off the turnip truck.
I got a youthful spirit.
No, yeah.
Yeah.
But an old soul, actually. Okay. What I was going to ask is how much of the coming battles in politics you think are really generational? Because somebody like J.D. Vance has certain affinities with people on the populist left, and he talks up, you know, the Biden's FTC commissioner, Lina Khan. He does not like free trade. He does not like interventionist wars, or he says so. It's very mixed. But, you know, how much of
politics is happening, it's
just, okay, there's the old people, and they all, no matter how different they are, they share certain common assumptions, and younger people, you know, also share.
It could be a combination of, you know, older people having more trust in institutions, but also that could be part of it. But I also think it's because my generation overall, we're just not doing as well. You know,
Do you think the future is populist?
Yes, I do. Yeah. I think there's a lot I hear from people all the time, especially in media spaces. They're like, I just want the Republicans to go back to how they were before and the Democrats to go back to how they were. I don't think that's
very good for the country.
I don't think that that's possible. Yeah. I really don't. I don't think we're just going to go back to a normal 1990s, 1980s time. Mm-hmm. I think that... everything is different now.
Yeah.
And we are in an affordability crisis.
Right.
Like, we really are. People out there are really hurting. They really, really are.
I guess as a final question, if the backdrop, becomes populist, is it going to be populism versus, like, right-wing populism versus left-wing populism, or is it going to be populism versus, for lack of a better term, libertarianism, where it's like, you know what, we've had over the past 25 years, you know, massive growth in government at all levels, massive controls and regulation on how businesses operate, how healthcare operates, how education operates, et cetera. Are people going to be like, you know what, we keep hearing that free markets fail. This is what J.D. Vance says. This is what Elizabeth Warren says. And it's like, maybe they haven't really been tried. Is libertarian and populists, are those going to be, is that going to be the new?
It could be. It could be like a Milei type. That's how you say Milei, right? I mean, if some figure like that were to emerge, I think, I don't really know, like, who does the libertarian, like, who do you guys have that is, like, your face?
Yeah.
Like, was it Rand Paul? Like,
it was in 2015 and Trump dispatched him.
Because that's part of it. You know, you kind of need, like, a person that's going to lead.
You need the weather, the lightning rod that captures everything and focuses it. Who do you think among the populace that are out there today, who do you think has the ability to really galvanize a movement?
The populace on the left or the right?
Either.
I think on the left, Zohran Mamdani.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, he can't be president. But I think he's going to be the left-wing populist.
Well, we've elected people who were not born in America in the past, right?
We
joking.
I was going to say
people like George, every American president before, I think, Andrew Jackson, because they were technically born.
Oh, fascinating.
Mamdani is
the kingmaker. I think, you could have, as far as the progressives in 2028, if Abdul El-Sayed wins his Senate race, damn. That would be the biggest.
He's Medicare for all.
I worked
all,
for him,
et cetera. So
I worked for him. I didn't write about in the book. No, I don't. I know.
Why not?
I like him personally as a person. He was very nice to me. He's like the issues that he's running on right now. He's not really even talking about affordability or the economy. Or he's running in Michigan. I never hear him talking about bringing jobs home.
Right.
It's all like abolish ICE and getting money out of politics, which I do support. But that's again, that's not what people are thinking about every day.
And he's got a lot of money. He doesn't need it. Right.
Totally.
Yeah.
Right. So no, he doesn't. He doesn't have the right policies for me.
Is there ever a time, and I guess we'll end on this, and I'm sorry that we have to shut down here, but somebody like Trump, a populist on the right, and is a billionaire, and then on the left, like somebody like Zoran Mamdani, or Abdullah Saeed, who has, and Saeed has what, like degrees from Oxford and an Ivy League school.
He's very elite.
Yeah. I mean, the shittiest school he went to was University of Michigan, which is like one
still
of the
a great
top
school,
20 colleges in America. Do we ever get somebody who's actually, from the class that they claim to represent?
No, and the reason why is because they wouldn't be able to stand them. Mm. The progressives would fucking hate them.
Yeah.
Because they would have real working class views.
Yeah.
That's the whole Graham Platner debacle, right?
Right.
They love this guy. Morris Katz absolutely loved this guy because he had all the same views as Zoran Mamdani, but looked like a working class character.
Yeah.
But if you want to actually appeal to working class people, you can't just pick people that are wearing working class costumes.
Right.
You have to get people who actually have real working class views. And I think they would actually just despise them and they would never do it.
All right. Well, we're going to leave it there. We've been talking with Evan Barker, author of the fascinating memoir, Nothing Left, Confessions of a Democratic Operative. Evan, thanks for talking to Reason.
Thank you.